But I also want to talk about this new notion of preparation non-contextuality, which is nothing like the traditional notion. The traditional one only concerned measurements. I decided to do this one first. So if you have any questions about how things connect with what I said at the beginning, it's coming up. But I'm going to focus on this first, because I think hopefully it'll answer some of your questions about how this sort of stuff works. So what I want to do now is prove that a preparation non-contextual invariable model of quantum theory is not possible. So first, I need to point out a couple of features that invariable theories have. So suppose you have a preparation P and a preparation P prime, and they're represented by some distributions, mu of lambda and mu prime of lambda, where lambda is the hidden variable. Now the question I want to ask is, how do you represent the fact that P and P prime are one-shot distinguishable with certainty? And by that, I mean there exists a measurement such that if I do that measurement, and the preceding that measurement was either P or P prime, but you don't know which, is there a measurement that allows you to tell which it was with certainty? So suppose I tell you, yes, there is a measurement that distinguishes P and P prime. What does that imply in the hidden variable model about how you represent P and P prime? Well, it implies that the overlap of those two distributions has to be zero. So they have to look like this rather than this. And the reason is simple to see. Suppose the contrary. Suppose they did overlap. Okay. Now, if they're one-shot distinguishable, it means there should exist some measurement that can tell them apart. But suppose I gave you the most powerful measurement you can possibly imagine, which is one that would tell you precisely what value of lambda there was. So there's nothing that's a better measurement in the context of this hidden variable theory, because it tells you everything. Even with that measurement, you couldn't discriminate this distribution from this distribution, this preparation from this preparation, because there are lambdas that are consistent with both. So these two preparation devices spit out a system which probabilistically has its state chosen from this distribution. The other guy spits out a system that has its state probabilistically chosen from this distribution. And we know that some of the time, the states they spit out are going to be exactly the same, because there's some probability of landing in this overlap space. And when it spits out a lambda in that region, no measurement you do, even if your measurement identifies what that lambda is, it won't be able to tell you whether it came from this distribution or that one. So you wouldn't be able to tell those two preparations apart, even with the most powerful measurement. So it must be the case that they don't overlap. Questions about that? Good? OK, so that's the first ingredient we need. The second ingredient is how to represent.
Yes. So the one on the left, yes? Say that they're one-shot distinguishability with certainty. That means
yes.
If you do one measurement,
right.
You'll definitely be able to tell them apart.
That's right.
Sorry, I was that.
Good. So the second question is, how do you represent a convex combination or a mixture of two preparation procedures? So suppose that I define a procedure P double prime as follows. Flip a coin, which has weighting P1 minus P. If heads comes up, implement preparation procedure big P. If tails comes up, implement preparation procedure big P prime. How do I represent that in the hidden variable model? Well, remember that this mu of lambda tells me the probability of generating lambda given that I implemented big P. And this tells me the probability of generating lambda given that I implemented P prime. So the probability of generating a state lambda when I implement P double prime is just the weighted sum of those two probabilities. So with probability little p, lambda comes out with probability mu of lambda. So that's the way you have to represent convex combination. It's just in the natural way, a convex combination of the distributions that are associated with those procedures. Now, does anyone object to that assumption? That is an assumption. I think it's a reasonable one because the only alternative I can imagine to it is the following, which is very bizarre. Suppose you had a preparation procedure and it spits out systems with the distribution mu of lambda when you press the button to go. But it has the strange feature that if prior to pressing the button, you over here you flip a coin to decide whether you're going to press the button or not. Now all of a sudden it doesn't spit out a distribution mu of lambda. it's a different distribution. So how it behaves depends on whether its implementation was preceded by a coin toss or not. Now that would be a kind of contextuality. It would say that, you know, in quantum mechanics, we don't expect this coin toss to affect the future statistics of that measurement. And so we should assume that there is no influence of tossing the coin. So you could say that this is a consequence of my assumption of non-contextuality.
It seems like that's kind of in the same status as Feldman's theory, so it does influence.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's possible, but it's very conspiratorial. Yeah. I mean, but maybe that's the way to go. Maybe that's worth thinking about. So I leave that open. But let's just point out this is an assumption that's being made in proof. Okay, so now, the proof involves just a two-level quantum system and the following six states. So there's actually six preparation procedures corresponding to just generating a system in one of these six pure states, which I've written down here. Now, some of you may be familiar with the Bloch sphere representation of two-dimensional quantum states. If so, then this is how the six states appear on a plane of the Bloch sphere. If not, don't worry about it. You can just do all the math and verify everything I'm saying. So notice that psi little a and psi big a are orthogonal, and similarly with little b and big b, little c and big c. And that's represented by antipodal points on the Bloch sphere. Now, let me replace those pure states by just the density operators corresponding to them. So here I've just written the projectors onto those pure states explicitly. And orthogonality now can be represented as the product of those two density operators being zero. That's just a convenient way to express those facts. Now, because I have orthogonality between little a and big a, that means that the preparation procedure, p little a and p big a, are distinguishable with certainty, one-shot distinguishable. There's a measurement I can do, which is just the measurement of this basis. The little a, big a basis, that will tell me which of these two preparations was done. And similarly with little b, big b, and little c, big c. And now remember from the previous overhead that the only way I can explain one-shot distinguishability is if the associated probability distributions are disjoint, so they don't overlap at all. So these three relations have to hold. So far, so good? Okay, now I'm going to define five new preparation procedures. Which are mixtures of others. So this guy here asks me to implement preparation procedure p little a with probability half and implement p big a with probability half and, you know, forget which of the two was done. So it's sort of a black box that flips a coin inside and implements one of the two. And similarly with the little b big b, little c big c guys. And now this one here asks me to prepare each of these three with probability a third and for each of these three with probability a third. Okay, now how do I represent that? Again, from the previous overhead, any convex combination of preparation procedures is going to be represented in the hidden variable theory by the same convex combination of the associated distributions. So the distribution I associate with this preparation procedure, mu little a big a, is a convex sum of the distributions I associate with this guy and this guy, and so on for all the rest. That's fine. Now we're going to get to the assumption of non-contextuality. It turns out that the mixture of little a big A and the mixture of little b big B are exactly the same density operator. So this is like the horizontal, vertical, and left circular, right circular business, where you have two mixtures that are absolutely indistinguishable statistically. In the Bloch sphere, that corresponds to the fact that convex combination is just represented by a point along the line joining them, and an equal convex combination is the point halfway between. So all the three of these guys are the same. And any triangle, so an equal mixture of these three, also lands in the center of the Bloch sphere, which is identity over two. But if you don't know about the Bloch sphere, then all you have to do is go back to the definitions I gave these to verify these relations. Now, what that tells me is that because these mixtures all associate with the same density operator, the associated preparation procedures are operationally equivalent. There is no measurement that you can do that will allow you to distinguish whether a mixture of little a and big A was prepared or a mixture of little b and big B was prepared. So these things are all operationally equivalent in the sense that I defined. And therefore, I can apply the assumption of preparation on contextuality, which says whenever these things are operationally indistinguishable, operationally equivalent, then they're associated with the same distribution. So it means that all these distributions that I had on the last overhead have to be the same, and I'll call them just nu of lambda. And so now I just have to derive a contradiction from this fact. So plugging all those guys into the equation I had on the previous slide, let me just flash it up again, this equation, all these guys are the same. So I can replace those five equations with these guys here, with the left-hand side the same for all of them. And now I just summarize everything I know. We want to find a set of probability distributions, six of them, such that they have this disjointness property and such that they satisfy these relations. And note that that parallels the quantum structure if you express it in terms of density operators. The density operators multiply to zero, and they have that convex structure as well. And it turns out you can't do it. And so all I have to prove is that there's no way to satisfy all these equations with probability distributions that are normalized. So here we go. Let's concentrate on these three relations to begin with. From this guy, I can infer that either little a or big A has to be zero at every lambda. So let me fix a lambda. Let's call it lambda prime. I'm going to focus on lambda prime. At lambda prime, one of these two has to be zero. Suppose it's mu little a. Well, then mu little a lambda prime is zero. But if it's the other, if it's mu big A, then if I plug that into this equation, I get that mu little a is twice nu. So I know that mu little a at lambda prime has to be zero or twice nu. And I can apply the same argument for these little b, big b bases. So mu little b has to be zero or twice nu. Mu little c is zero or twice nu. And now I can plug these six possibilities into this equation. Right? So suppose all three of them are zero. Plug that into the right-hand side. That would say that nu has to be zero. But suppose I chose lambda prime to be somewhere where nu was not zero. I mean, there's always a lambda prime such that the completely mixed state, this is a normalized distribution, so I can always find some lambda prime when it's non-zero. So zero is not equal to nu at lambda prime. So I try something else. I say, suppose two of them were zero and one was twice nu. Plug that in. So these guys would be zero. This guy would be twice nu. But that would give me two-thirds nu on the right-hand side, not nu. And similarly, if one was zero and two of them were two times nu, then I would get four-thirds nu on the right-hand side, and that's no good. Or they could all be of this form, and then they get twice nu on the right-hand side, and that's still not equal to nu. So none of these substitutions work. So I have a contradiction, and I'm done. Yes?
Yes. What's your opinion about, I think, Adrian, this sort of,
yep.
Has done this. If you look at, okay, so you're dealing with finite precision measurements, right?
Well, if we were talking about a proof of measurement contextuality,
yes,
I might be. But this proof here is a proof of preparation contextuality.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's going to be hard to answer your question in the context of this slide,
yeah,
but ask it anyhow. Sure. Yeah.
So then, if you're doing finite precision measurements, then you can look at dense subsets rather than, obviously there have been arguments made that you can color almost all the color, I mean, you can describe these 0 and 1 values consistently for almost all.
Yeah.
And you can imagine dense subsets that don't have, so the problem, what I want to say is that the problem with these proofs that use only a finite number of vectors has the problem that you can imagine a dense set that doesn't have a subset that is non-colorable or that could be used to this.
Well, I'm familiar with Adrian's paper on whether finite precision effects nullifies the Cochin spectra theorem. I can tell you what my personal opinion is on that sort of stuff. So if you take my definition of non-contextuality, it says if two preparation procedures are operationally equivalent, then they have to be represented exactly the same way. But in practice, you can never prove that two things are equivalent because you never take infinite amounts of statistics. So if you ever do finite statistics, no two things will ever be judged to be completely equivalent. There's always error. So the best you can do, a robust notion of non-contextuality cannot be of the form that I specified. A robust notion would have to be of the form, if two things are similar operationally, so if the statistics they give over the set of all measurements for one is very close to the statistics over all measurements for the other, in some metrical sense on the space of all statistics, then the representations in the hidden variable model should be close relative to some metric over the probability distributions in the hidden variable model. So now you have to have two metrics, and you can ask, well, what's the appropriate metric to use? What should closeness here operationally correspond to in the hidden variable model? I don't really have a good answer, but I suppose what you could do at that stage is just say, you want to know how much discontinuity there is. So a proof of contextuality would be basically saying, I have a proof that things that are close over here have to be yay far apart in the hidden variable model, increase in how far apart they are is a measure of how contextual that statistics was. So my response is that you should just move to a more robust notion of non-contextuality and then quantify how much contextuality. Yes?
So you assume non-contextuality and convexity, right, and derived contradiction, so one of the two is false. Saying the former should be false because it's less.
What do I want to say about that?
Because something's wrong with classical theory, it seems like you're choosing one over the other.
My sense is that actually what is most likely to be false is something deeper, something about the framework that we're using. So I think in any situation, there's always a lot of assumptions you're making that you're not writing down explicitly. And the same thing's true here, that there are a lot of assumptions that in prior to getting to this proof. And I suspect that it's really one of those that's probably got to go if this invariable research program is to be successful. So I'm not very enthused with invariable models that are sort of contextual by construction or non-local by construction, where you imagine that changing something over here immediately influences properties over there. You can put in contextuality by hand and try to mock up the quantum statistics. But those sorts of approaches don't really appeal to me. So I actually think that all this shows that there's something deeper, some fundamental assumption we're making further back, which is wrong, and I don't really know what it is, but yeah,
maybe
something
it's
has
that
to go.
We should use hidden variable theory.
Maybe it's that we shouldn't use hidden variable theory.
Maybe that's an assumption.
Yeah, that could be it.
Sorry, maybe it's not. Just
yeah, no, I agree with you. It certainly could be. To some extent, I agree. Insofar as the term hidden variable theory refers to this framework, I totally agree. Insofar as there's this sort of picture that there's something that we don't know and a quantum state represents our lack of knowledge about that, I think the idea is right. So, okay. Yes.
So how objectionable is this notion that or this non-contextuality within the hidden variables? And the reason I ask this is because if you take something like gauge theory, you can have different gauges that correspond to the same physics.
Yep.
Or even a very simple example, if you use standard wave functions in quantum mechanics, you can put an arbitrary phase in front of it, overall phase, and it doesn't
mm-hmm.
change anything. You have different representations within your mathematics, within the structures that you're looking at, that give rise to the same predictions, and yet we don't complain about those. So, how objectionable is this really, or how does it fit in?
I think it's different because I could imagine an aspect of my hidden variable theory that could be just completely eliminated. It would be like a gauge degree of freedom, that it wouldn't influence the statistics of anything. That's different from what we have here, because what I have are sort of two sorts of distributions that give all the same statistics. But there's no way I could sort of just eliminate a few degrees of freedom and have them be the same. Because if I eliminate degrees of freedom and have them be the same, then I would have a non-contextual hidden variable model. So whereas with gauge degrees of freedom, we can sort of come up with an equivalent relational description. It might be very cumbersome, to eliminate degrees of freedom, work only in terms of the relational variables. We don't have something comparable here. We can't make a theory non-contextual.
So the point is that you can get rid of the gauge degree of freedom, whereas you can't get rid of
non-contextual.
Okay.
Can't get rid of the contextual.
Very good
answer. More questions? Good. So that's just a quick proof of preparation contextuality. Now I want to make some comments on the connection between this revised notion of measurement non-contextuality and the traditional one. So let me again start with some general comments about hidden variable models, in particular how you represent coarse graining of measurement outcomes. So this is comparable to the first slide of the last section. So suppose you have two measurement procedures, M and M prime, and they're represented by sets of indicator functions, chi k, chi j prime. And now suppose that the outcomes k of the first measurement can be sorted into subsets labeled by j. So I'll just call those subsets sj. And suppose that M prime is a coarse graining of M in the following sense. The way you implement M prime is by implementing M, and upon obtaining the outcome k, you just record the j value that describes the set that k is bound in. Right? And then you just report that j value. So the whole thing's happening in a black box, and what comes out of the black box is the j. But inside the black box is a measurement of m, you get a k value, and you only register some of its properties. So if you ask, well, how do you represent that in the hidden variable model, you just have to remind yourself that what these expressions mean. This indicator function is just the probability of getting j given that the system fed into the device was lambda. But the probability for that is just going to be the probability that it was any k consistent with the subset j given lambda. So I should sum up all the conditional probabilities. So if k1, k2, and k3 are all in the subset sj, then the probability of j given lambda is just the probability of k1 given lambda plus the probability of k2 given lambda plus the probability of k3 given lambda. And so you sum them up, and you find, not surprisingly, that the way you represent coarse graining of preparation procedures is just a coarse graining of the indicator functions.
Rob, sorry, yes? Do you intend this for your unsharp ones, or only like for the diagrams, the sharp traditional?
Yeah, I would say that I'm assuming the sharp measurements, so these guys really are idempotent indicator functions. But the same comments would be true even if they weren't. But certainly the diagram doesn't capture that generality. And I'm not going to need the generality for what I'm about to say. Diagrammatically, the cartoon is that if the first measurement has these three outcomes, and then I coarse grain these two, then in the hidden variable theory, that just corresponds to taking the sum of these two indicator functions, like so. Okay, so now think back to what the traditional notion of non-contextuality was. It said that if you have two bases, like these two that have an element in common, then they ought to be represented by sets of indicator functions that have that are the same for that element. But it turns out this is exactly equivalent, I can derive this from the novel notion of non-contextuality. What I need to apply my novel notion are two measurements that are operationally equivalent. And the two measurements here are not operationally equivalent. These two devices can be distinguished because they yield different statistics on these sorts of outcomes. So then they're not the sorts of things I can apply my criterion to. But if I just coarse grain psi 2 and psi 3, and I coarse grain psi 2 prime and psi 3 prime, I get two different measurements that are operationally equivalent. Right? So if measurement M is defined as do this and then coarse grain, it's represented by this projector value measure, psi 1 versus some rank 2 projector, which I just call identity minus psi 1. And similarly with this guy, he's a different list of instructions compared to this guy. The instructions say measure this other basis and then coarse grain. But nonetheless, he's represented in the quantum formalism in exactly the same way as just psi 1 versus identity minus psi 1. So there's no preparation procedure that will yield different statistics for these two guys. They always look the same from the perspective of all preparation procedures. So they're represented by the same pair of indicator functions. So starting from that, knowing that the fine-grained procedure just corresponds to breaking this up in some way, I can deduce the former picture, that chi 1 has to be the same in these two cases because of this fact that chi 1 is the same for these two measurements. So let me pause and ask whether that argument was clear. Yeah? Yes. Yeah.
So is your new definition somewhat stronger than the older one?
I would say it's a generalization in the sense that it now applies not only to sharp measurements, but to preparations and POVM measurements, unsharp measurements as well.
But apart from that, the other way to be fair, the sharp measurements, you mean that requiring the new non-penetrating is stronger than requiring the old one?
Yes. Right. I'll answer your question momentarily. So there's a subtlety here that, I'm just about to get to it, so I may as well just postpone the question. So here's the subtlety, which is, didn't we say that the most general representation of any measurement was in terms of indicator functions that weren't necessarily idempotent, that weren't necessarily black. Can we really derive the traditional notion from this general assumption? These two measurements, for instance, don't even need to be associated with flat indicator functions. So how do I get back to the old notion of contextuality when I start with this more general representation? There's an answer to that. But let me point out what the situation is. What we're basically seeing is that this revised notion of non-contextuality only gives you the traditional notion if you supplement it with a further assumption, which is that sharp measurements are represented by flat indicator functions. I call that assumption outcome determinism for sharp measurements. It means if you feed a system into one of these sharp measurement devices, the value of the hidden variables specifies with certainty what outcome you'll get. So the outcome is deterministic given the hidden variables. So it turns out that it looks like our revised notion is actually different from the traditional notion, because the traditional notion involves this extra assumption. So as I say, it's not simply a generalization, it's a revision of the concept. So you might say, well, you shouldn't have used the same term, but I think sometimes you keep the term and revise the notion. I think this is a better notion of non-contextuality than the traditional one, because it separates cleanly the issue of contextuality from the issue of determinism. And it seems to me these are separate issues. So John Bell, for instance, famously separated the notion of locality from the notion of determinism. And he introduced the notion of local causality, which asked whether events over here, the probability of events over here depended on what you did over there, not just whether the events themselves depended on what you did, but the probabilities. And similarly here, I think it's worthwhile to separate out the question of whether your representation depends on context from the question of, is your representation deterministic? Does the outcome get specified by the hidden variable or not? They're two different issues. Yes.
On the previous slide, what's the additional ingredient that makes them equivalent again?
Outcome determinism for sharp measurements. So sharp measurements are ones that are associated with projective value measures rather than positive operator value measures. And it basically says that those measurements ought to be represented. They're the only ones that ever appear in the traditional groups. They ought to be represented, but not by any old indicator functions like this, but by indicator functions that only take the value 0 and 1. Which means that these POVMs are always imagined to have their outcomes completely specified by the value of the hidden variables. Yes?
Why is every simple function to make that distinction between the shuttle symmetry between PVMs and POVMs?
You're saying, you know, why should I say that, why shouldn't I say that there's outcome determinism for POVMs as well, for instance? Okay, well, so, good. Here all I'm doing is saying, what's the minimal thing I would need to assume to get back to the traditional notion? But you could ask another question, which you could say, well, is this a reasonable assumption? Or you could ask a third question, which is, you know, might it be reasonable to assume outcome determinism in even more instances, like for POVMs? So what I'm going to not prove, but just tell you, is that it turns out that you can justify this assumption, outcome determinism for sharp measurements, from an assumption of preparation non-contextuality. So there's this interesting connection. I've introduced this new notion of non-contextuality for preparations. And it turns out from it, I can derive this assumption, but I can't derive it for unsharp measurements.
So what about more and more frequent every POVM?
Yes.
Is that not
problematic? No, because what happens is that if you have two POVMs that are equivalent, operationally equivalent, then you say, well, they have to be represented the same way in the hidden variable model. And now you want, but they're different. They've been implemented in different ways. You know, for instance, you know, this one tossed a certain kind of dice, and this one tossed a different kind of dice. Now you do the Neumark extension, and you take that dice and you make it part of the quantum system. It's your ancilla, and you do a projective value measurement on the dice and the system. But the fact that the dice degree of freedom is different in the two cases means that now they're not operationally equivalent on the larger Hilbert space. And so they don't satisfy the conditions for non-contextuality anymore. Right, so before we get to the justification of this assumption, I just want to point out that this is bad news for deriving no-go theorems, because previously we knew that we could derive contradictions from this assumption, which means that we can derive contradictions from these two assumptions, but in the face of a contradiction, we don't know that it's non-contextuality that has to go. Maybe it's outcome determinism that has to go. So you've opened up, you've all of a sudden jeopardized all this, you know, body of traditional work that says that you can't have non-contextuality. So suddenly my new definition says, well, maybe we can. Maybe it was determinism we had to give up. But that's not the case. There is a notion of non-contextuality we have to give up. Either measurement or preparation non-contextuality. Because you can prove, and I don't have time to do it, but preparation non-contextuality actually implies outcome determinism for sharp measurements. And so overall, the pair of assumptions, measurement and preparation non-contextuality, implies both non-contextuality for sharp measurements and outcome determinism for sharp measurements, and that's just the traditional notion. So all the contradictions you derive from here now become proofs that one of these guys has to go. So if you take non-contextuality to be the assumption that all experimental procedures, preparations, and measurements have to be non-contextual, then all your traditional proofs go through as proofs of the impossibility of this universal non-contextuality. Right, so it's a bit of a subtle structure, but the point is that you now have this more general notion. It captures the old notion in this sort of way. It distinguishes determinism from contextuality. And using it, you can come up with many new proofs of the impossibility of non-contextual hidden variable models, and you can do it even in two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. So the former restriction of these proofs to three-dimensional Hilbert spaces was an artifact, according to this view, of a limited notion of what it is to be a context. So the only sorts of contexts that they recognized were different ways of fine-graining rank 2 or greater than rank 1 projectors. But other notions of contexts are things like if you have an unsharp measurement, a POVM, it can often be written as a convex sum of PVMs in multiple different ways. or it can be Neumark extended in multiple different ways. And so even if so, for POVMs in a two-dimensional Hilbert space, you can derive contradictions with the assumption of contextuality. Good. So I guess I want to end with a few general comments about contextuality. And how much time is there left total?
You began at 10:05.
I began at 10:05, so I have. Oh, okay. So I have 25, a bit less than 25 minutes. So okay, let me go through some general statements about contextuality. So is it mysterious? I would say yes, because and I think it's mysterious in the same sense that Bell's theorem is mysterious. So if you don't think that Bell's theorem is mysterious, then maybe you shouldn't think that this is mysterious either. But for me, the mystery of Bell's theorem is not that we have to contend with non-locality. That would have been fine. It would have just shown our previous theories were wrong, and you know, it turns out that the universe is non-local. What strikes me as odd about Bell's theorem is that if there is, I know we didn't get around to it this morning, but unfortunately I can't go into the details. So for those of you who don't know what Bell's theorem is, I apologize. But essentially, what seems mysterious to me is that Bell's theorem tells you that at a hidden variable level, you have to have superluminal causation. So you really have to have influences that propagate back from the speed of light. And yet you know that you can't use those influences to signal. Right? So the quantum formalism still does not allow signaling faster than the speed of light. And it's that tension that I think is the real mystery. You know, fine, let there be superluminal causes, but why is it that the theory doesn't allow us to use them? That seems a bit like a conspiracy. I want good reasons for why we can't use those superluminal causal mechanisms. And my impression is that nobody has really provided me with reasons that are adequate. So the same thing's true here. What you have is a tension between the fact that the representation in the hidden variable theory can depend on certain details of the experimental procedure, even though the outcome statistics don't depend on those details at all. So, you know, I would say, well, fine, there's some details of the experimental procedure that previously we thought weren't important, but lo and behold, this hidden variable theory tells me they are important, and they affect the nature of the systems that come out of it. But then why isn't it that I can't do some measurement that sees that difference? How is that conspiracy set up? Anyways, that's most people, I would say, don't agree with me on this. So if you don't agree with me, then you're in good company. This new notion of non-contextuality is also very useful as sort of an umbrella for capturing lots of different notions of non-classicality, lots of things that go on in quantum foundations literature. Lots of puzzles become instances of this very general notion of contextuality. So, for instance, all the traditional versions of the Bell equation spectral theorem, and there's lots of different kinds of proofs, they're all instances of this new notion. All variants of Bell's theorem, so all kinds of non-locality, are instances of contextuality. The usual way of seeing that is just to note that non-locality is a scenario wherein not only does your measurement depend on the context of, you know, how it was done, but that context might be far away. So if I have a measurement, for instance, that's, I'll write it over here so everyone can see, a projector value measure that just measures the z-spin on a system B. I have a pair of systems A and B. So this is my projector value measure. If the person at A does a measurement of z versus x, that corresponds to two ways of fine-graining this measurement into a four-outcome measurement. And so the statement that the way I represent this in the hidden variable theory doesn't depend on whether Alice measured Z or X is a statement of non-contextuality. It says it doesn't matter how you fine-grain this two-outcome measurement into four-outcome measurements, you should represent it the same way. So non-locality is just a particular instance of contextuality. And so you can see all those proofs of non-locality as proofs of contextuality. Then there's, of course, these novel NOGO theorems I was referring to. You can read about them in this paper. It turns out that there's certain aspects of pre- and post-selection paradoxes which are connected to proofs of contextuality. Also, the fact that you have to have negativity in quasi-probability representations of quantum theory. So the Wigner representation is an instance of a quasi-probability representation. These are basically real-valued representations of states and measurements that sometimes go negative. That's why the quasi is there. So you could ask, well, the Wigner function goes negative, but is it the case that every representation has to go negative? And a proof of contextuality actually is a proof that all quasi-probability representations have to go negative somewhere. And then it turns out that von Neumann's no-go theorem is also an instance of this generalized notion. And finally, just recently with collaborators, I was able to show that contextuality is actually good for something, because there are certain information processing tasks, in particular, they involve their communication tasks, that you get an advantage over the classical version of the task, if only if your theory is contextual. So a necessary condition for getting an advantage over the classical version of the task is to have a contextual theory. So not just quantum mechanics, but not necessarily quantum mechanics, but any contextual theory. So that's kind of nice, because people have come up with similar sorts of statements about non-locality. It turns out there's certain communication complexity protocols for which non-local theories outperform local theories. So now we have instances of that for contextuality as well. So for all these reasons, I find it an interesting topic. In the short time remaining, I think I'm going to move on. So let me conclude on this topic. So one of the points I've made is that the notion of contextuality can and should be separated from the notion of outcome determinism, whether your outcomes are specified by the hidden variables. And it can be extended beyond sharp measurements, which was the only scenario in which the traditional notion applied, to preparations and unsharp measurements. And it can be made operational, so it's not specific to quantum theory. You can talk about an arbitrary operational theory, whether it's contextual or not. And because of that, you can now subject it to experimental tests. You can ask whether the data is consistent with a contextual or a non-contextual theory. And there's a group in at the university, at Griffith University in Queensland, Jeff Pride's group. It's an experimental quantum optics group. I suggested that they do a particular, very simple version of contextuality proof involving just a single qubit. And in a sense, we already know that the world is contextual because all the Bell experiments proved it. As I said earlier, every proof of non-locality is also a proof of contextuality. So we already knew the world was contextual, so why bother doing an experiment? Well, it turns out that if you make a dedicated experiment to just proving contextuality, you only need one qubit, one two-level system. You don't need a pair of entangled systems. And so you can actually do better. So by designing a dedicated experiment, you can become more certain of the fact that the world is contextual than you are of the fact that the world is non-local. And so we were able to derive a deviation, sort of a contextuality inequality, and we have like a 5,000 sigma deviation from what a non-contextual theory would predict, which is kind of overkill. But the best known non-locality tests only show like 1,000 sigma deviation. So, and they've told me that they have new results now, and I don't know how many sigma away from non-contextual that they've achieved, but maybe it's an order of magnitude. I'm hoping that it's a factor of 10. It's always nice to say we improved the experiment by an order of magnitude. last couple of points is that contextuality power is better than classical performance of certain information processing tasks. Finally, it's an umbrella for lots of different notions of non-classicality. So there's a few open questions, which I'll leave you with, because if you're interested in this stuff, there's lots of work to be done. What other notions of non-classicality might be instances of contextuality? And so one contender, one thing that I think is likely, is that fermionic statistics ends up being a proof of contextuality, the existence of fermionic statistics. I have some vague reasons for thinking that might be the case. You can also ask what other information processing tasks, besides this communication task we've come up with, might be powered by contextuality. And one possibility is the exponential speedup in quantum computation. But that may be completely wrong. I'm not sure there's very good reasons for thinking it. But I think it's useful to set it up as a conjecture to be knocked down, because you might learn something interesting. Can you quantify contextuality as a resource? If it is useful, how do you quantify it? Why isn't the world more contextual than it is? So this parity oblivious 2-to-1 random access code is the communication protocol that I didn't present to you. But it turns out that quantum mechanics allows you to do this protocol with 85% probability of success. But you can imagine a world where you do it with 100% probability of success. That would be a more contextual world than the one we live in. Why is quantum theory only so contextual and not more? People have, Sandu, I'm not sure if Sandu's here, have asked similar questions about the amount of non-locality we have in quantum theory. Why not more? You can ask a similar question for contextuality. And then finally, I think the really important question is trying to resolve the mystery. What physical principle, if any, relieves the tension between the context dependence at the hidden variable level and the lack of context dependence at the operational level? What dispels this illusion of a conspiracy? Good, and that's it for contextuality. Let me pause for any questions on that topic. Yes?
So you were saying earlier that we have to give up either measurement non-contextuality or preparation non-contextuality. It seems to me that giving up preparation non-contextuality, it's more appealing. Do you have any comments on which you would choose, or are there reasons for your choice?
You know, I think I did say that at one point. Those words came out of my mouth, but I misspoke. Because the first thing I showed, the first no-go theorem I showed you, started from preparation non-contextuality and derived a contradiction. So you know you can't have preparation non-contextuality already. And so you can have measurement non-contextuality, it turns out. In there's the one kind of, it's not even a hidden variable model, it's just sort of a realist model wherein you think that the physical state of systems is completely specified by the quantum state. And it turns out that this one kind of model is, according to my definition, technically measurement non-contextual. It turns out that it's really preparation non-contextuality is a more fundamental notion. Yeah?
I just want to see how you respond to this. So I would like to cook up a contextual example in classical mechanics. So imagine these guys. Their lab consists of a slot machine where you can put in dollars or quarters, and you can put in them in different directions and so on. And then, of course, the slot machine wants to determine if it is a dollar or a quarter, so it either goes through one channel where the size is measured, or another channel which the mass is measured. And then, of course, at the end of the day, the coin drops on the floor and you get the outcome heads or tails.
Okay.
So now you're going to call that a measurement of the coin. It's going to be heads or tails. That's a binary outcome. Right? You can perform that measurement together with the size of the coin or with the mass of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
The first trivial observation you make is that the statistics of heads and tails is 50-50, no matter what measurement you do together with. The second thing you notice is that if I know this by classical mechanics, then, of course, you see that the individual outcomes can depend on measuring context. So here you have a classical example where the individual outcomes do depend on the context, but the long-term statistics, heads and tails, do not. And of course, there's nothing surprising about this. So that's sort of my. I would like to see how you react. Of course, this example here is not after the Broglie Bohm's quantum theory, where context reality works out.
I'm not sure I have the right response to this setup, but what I would ask is, if you imagine a limited set of measurements, can you say this is a classical model? It's not really classical mechanics, because to characterize whether classical mechanics is contextual or not, we have to ask, what are all the possible measurements? So if you say I have two preparation procedures, and maybe my slot machine can't distinguish them, but there exists a possible classical measurement that could distinguish them, then I would say classical mechanics is non-contextual, because every distinct set of distributions is separated by some measurement. And the fact that your slot machine, which is a subset of all possible measurements that can be done in classical mechanics, can't discriminate them is not.
And of course, my answer is going to be now. I'm going to add to this scenario that these experimentalists are sort of doing more of. They actually think that these are the only kinds of experiments you can do. So it's very similar in the Broglie Bohm theory, that you can have a notion of quantum measurements, which work very much in this way. So just to make an example here. In this slot machine example, depending if you do the size measurement or the mass measurement, you change the Hamiltonian. You implement a different Hamiltonian, and the trajectories of the coin can be completely different. And if it happens, if it ends up a tail or heads, it's strictly going to depend on what Hamiltonian you implement. In Bohm's theory, for example, if you do A together with B or A together with C, you're going to have two different unitary evolutions or two different Hamiltonians, which of course generates two different wave functions, which in Bohm's theory generates two different trajectories on configuration space. And that, of course, you're going to be able to get two different outcomes. So it's very much the same. Like in the case with the slot machine, you don't discover what? You have the non-contextual statistics, 50-50 if you measure size or mass, because those special initial distributions of everything, there's some wavelength vibrations and so on.
Let me interrupt you, Hans, because I'm running out of time. I think I agree with you that it's very easy to construct toy models that are contextual. But what I think is difficult to construct are models that have sort of an elegant structure. So, you know, real candidates for physical theories. Things wherein, you know, the set of measurements is, you know, closed under various nice algebraic operations and have nice symmetry properties. And, you know, to construct a contextual model of that sort, I mean, there are some on the table. But that's a very different sort of task from just creating a little toy model. And if you take classical mechanics as the theory which allows all measurements that are possible classically, with, you know, no additional restrictions, no ad hoc added additions, then it is by definition non-contextual. All right. So I'm going to just get to the last topic of the talk, which is this question of whether quantum states describe reality or are knowledge of reality. And Chris Fuchs is going to be talking more about this, so I'm going to say very little. And I'm also going to be talking about it from a hidden variable theory perspective, which Chris won't be doing. This is a really nice quote by E.T. James about how the ontological and epistemological aspects of quantum theory have been all scrambled up by Heisenberg and Bohr into an omelet that nobody has seen how to unscramble. Yet we think that the unscrambling is a prerequisite for any further advance in basic physical theory. For if we cannot separate the subjective and objective aspects of the formalism, we cannot know what we are talking about. It's just that simple. And I wholeheartedly subscribe to that point of view. People who tell me it doesn't make a difference whether I'm talking about reality or knowledge of reality annoy me. I think it makes a huge difference. These are different categories of thing, reality and knowledge of reality. In our everyday life, we make the distinction. In physical theories, we ought to as well. So I want to try to make that distinction in the context of hidden variable theories. So in fact, I'm going to make a pair of distinctions, which I'm going to call psi-complete versus psi-incomplete, and psi-ontic versus psi-extemic. And I'm going to give you caricatures again of what these things are. So a psi-complete realist model of quantum mechanics is one wherein the complete physical state of the system is completely specified by psi, the Ray and Hilbert space. And so I can, you know, represent the Rays and Hilbert space as just a single axis. So my state space is a single axis, which varies over the Rays and Hilbert space, and my physical state is a point on that axis. That, I would say, is a psi-complete model. It's a model that you hear about a lot in textbooks. You know, people often assume that the complete physical state of the system is just a Ray and Hilbert space. A psi-incomplete model is what typically goes by the name of a hidden variable model. You assume that there's something in addition to psi that needs to be specified. Psi is not enough. But there's two distinct ways in which you can have a psi-incomplete model. The first I'll characterize by this sort of diagram. One of your axes in the physical state space is labeled by psi, but you have another axis labeled, for instance, by lambda. And your physical state, a complete description of physical state, is a point in that space. But a different way in which you could be incomplete is if psi doesn't represent an axis in your physical state space. It just is a way of labeling probability distributions over your physical state space. Right? So you just have some lambda, and then different psi's correspond to different probability distributions. So that intuitively is what I mean by the difference between psi-ontic and psi-epistemic. In psi-ontic models, quantum state is part of the description of reality. So this model is psi-ontic. Quantum state is all there is to reality. Here, it's part of the description of reality, but it's not the whole reality. And here, it doesn't describe reality, it describes knowledge of reality. So that's the intuitive, rough and ready approach.
What's
yes?
the difference between the complete state is psi and yep. the complete state is lambda? Those are just labels to me.
The complete state is psi plus.
Are you thinking of two diagrams and asking what the difference between them is?
Yeah,
this one and this one?
The psi-complete picture and the yeah. psi-epistemic picture.
Ah, okay, well, I think my rough and ready explanation wasn't enough to satisfy you, so I move on to the more rigorous, which is, will satisfy you. Note that I can always describe a theory in terms of what I know about the physical state. So if the theory says when you've done a preparation procedure that you characterize by the vector psi, the physical state of the system is also characterized by psi, it's just as good for me to say my knowledge of the physical state of the system is a delta function centered on psi. I'm saying the same thing. So I can represent it by my knowledge. And now here, this sort of model is represented by the fact that when the preparation procedure puts out a state psi, my knowledge is represented by a delta function along psi, but it's something else along this other axis, which mysteriously has become omega. And so it doesn't have to be flat, it could be something else. But my state of knowledge of what is the physical state of the system that popped out of the apparatus associated with psi is going to be something like this. And now, here's the key thing. I ask, how does my state of knowledge change when I change the quantum state associated with my preparation procedure? So if I have a different state, psi prime, I ask, what do I know about the physical state of the system when I prepare psi prime? Well, it's a different delta function. So it doesn't overlap with the first delta function. And similarly here, psi prime is associated with a distribution which is not a delta function along this axis, but it still doesn't overlap with the first distribution at all. Whereas in this picture, the two distributions will overlap. And that's the key difference between psi-ontic and psi-epistemic. Whether the distribution over the physical states associated with psi overlaps with the distribution associated with psi prime. So to use equations rather than pictures, a psi-complete model is one for which the complete state is just psi. A psi-ontic model, allowing it to be contextual, I have to sort of be a bit fiddly and say, if I have two preparation procedures, p psi 1 and p psi 2, that are associated with a pair of distinct quantum states, then the distribution over the hidden variables associated with p psi 1 and the distribution associated with p psi 2 don't overlap anywhere. They're disjoint. Whereas for psi epistemic models, they will overlap somewhere for some lambda. And so intuitively, what's going on here is, I just go back to the pictures. What I'm asking is it the case that a complete specification of the physical state encodes the quantum state or not? In these two pictures, If I tell you where you are in the state space, there's only a single quantum state that's consistent with it. Whereas over here, if I tell you you're in this region of the state space, then there's multiple quantum states that are consistent with being there. So that's why I choose to call this the psi epistemic model. It means that for a given physical state, there are multiple possible psis. And therefore, psi can't be a description of reality. It has to be a description of my knowledge of reality. Yes?
So this distinction in the bottom relies on an assumption of hidden variables, though. Is that correct?
Yes, it does. Essentially, there's one caveat there, which is sometimes I like to call these models, everything I've been talking about today, and refer it to as hidden variable models, sometimes convenient to call them just ontological models, mm-hmm. really? Because they're meant to include that model wherein the only physical variable you have is the quantum state. And some people would object that it's very stupid to call this a hidden variable model, because if you know that the preparation was psi, there's nothing left to be known. There's no extra variables that are unknown. There's nothing hidden. And so some people argue that this shouldn't be called a hidden variable model, but I want to include it in the set of models that I'm considering. But except for that caveat, yes, I agree.
The pilot wave,
yes. Good.
Is ontic, but on the other hand, if you tell me what lambda is, you told me everything about it. So I don't know where to put this.
I don't see the contradiction there.
So I have to choose with the pilot wave whether yep. I'm on the bottom left or the bottom right.
Yeah, and the answer is you're here.
But then doesn't that conflict with the definition you had on the next slide, which if I remember it said...
So let me tell you why I would why the pilot wave model is psi incomplete. You need more than the quantum state, but it's psi ontic. And the reason is that not only, so if you ask what are the physical states of affairs in Bohmian mechanics, it's not just a specification of the positions of all the particles. It's a specification of the position of all particles together with a specification of the quantum state of the universal wave function. That is the physical state space. And so I can draw Bohmian mechanics. You know, this axis will correspond, roughly speaking, to configurations of all the particles, but you have another axis which corresponds to the universal wave function. And so the universal wave function, Bohmian mechanics, is something real. It's a pilot wave. It pushes things around. And if you imagine a universe with a different psi, then it's a physically different universe. It pushes things around in different ways. So if the only reason that this, you know, you might think that this is the way to characterize Bohmian mechanics is if you leave out the axis which has psi on it. If you just think, what about the configuration space? Ah, then different psis correspond to different distributions. But you can't do that because the quantum state really is state of part of the complete description of the physical state in Bohm mechanics. Again, there's a caveat, which is that some people, some Bohmians, would argue that you should not interpret the quantum state that way. You should interpret it as a law, as a normative status. In that case, you might be able to make an argument that Bohmian mechanics can be interpreted as a psi-epistemic model. I've had that debate with some people, and I haven't really come to a conclusion yet, so I don't know what to say about it.
You're all.
Let me take a question here, and then move to the back.
So your proof for the convex duality are only valid for the psi-ontic theories?
No, they were valid for all these models. They didn't make any assumptions. Yes. Yes. Okay.
This bottom doesn't this ruin part of the proof is bottom line?
I see what you're saying. The equations like this that appeared in my proof referred to orthogonal states. Okay. So what I said was true of all hidden variable theories is that if you have two orthogonal states, then necessarily they're represented by disjoint distributions. But this question of whether your model is psi-ontic or psi-epistemic asks you to look at how you represent non-orthogonal states. They're the only ones that are going to be able to distinguish these two sorts of models. Mm-hmm. Right? So the psi-epistemic model says for some pair of non-orthogonal states, this overlap is non-zero. Whereas for psi-ontic models, not just the orthogonal states, but all the non-orthogonal states are, as well, are always disjoint. I I think, Piero, Luca, you had a question.
Are you assuming a one-to-one correspondence between the psi and the p, not a one, you're excluding a one-to-many correspondence?
A one-to-many correspondence between the psi and
so
the p.
So to speak, two preparation in the, two distributions in the hidden variable models can lead to the same estimate.
No, I'm not assuming that, because that would be preparation contextuality. If one density operator is represented by multiple distributions, then it's preparation contextual. And that is not being excluded here.
Are you assuming it appears that it's
I'm assuming what it appears to be.
That appears that it's been supposing the
distribution. Well, no, because I've adopted this notation, where I say this distribution could depend on the actual list of instructions you did, right? So this is a dependence on a preparation procedure. And I've just put in a subscript, a psi 1. So if you can find some way of implementing a preparation procedure for psi 1 and some way of implementing a preparation procedure for psi 2 such that the distributions have some overlap, then it has to be psi extending.
Because there is a theorem which says that the p states of something nice must be mapped to p states in your hidden variable, so pure delta distribution. So I don't see how case two.
Why do we have to be mapped by delta?
It must be like that. They can't go inside the convex set of your syntax in your hidden variable.
In a non-contextual theory, you mean? No. No. Yes.
They can't because you lose some measurements, quantum mechanical measurements. They become impossible. It is very impossible. Or something like that. We can speak about it.
Okay. So we're basically out of time. So I'm going to just leave you with one open question, which is interesting. Most of the hidden variable theories that we have are all of this type here. They're psi incomplete. They add something to the quantum state, but they're psi object. So Bohmian mechanics falls in that category. Modal interpretations fall in that category. Every hidden variable theory I know of, besides one that was proposed and only works for sharp measurements in a 2D Hilbert space, proposed by Cush and Specker, except for that one example, they're always of this sort. And so the open question is, can we find hidden variable models of quantum theory of this sort? It's really an unexplored avenue, largely unexplored avenue in foundations. Jonathan Barrett has a result. He has a very ad hoc theory, which actually does manage to be epistemic. And so now we've revised the question to, can you have a psi epistemic model such that it has the right symmetry properties, that the fidelity between, so the measure of the overlap of these two guys is invariant under unitary transformations, because that would be a property that you would like it to have. And that's an open question. Nobody knows the answer to, so I urge you to work on it. Thanks.